Hello, everyone. And several of these early lectures are going to say, this is the first lecture, and this actually will be chronologically the first one you listen to. This picks up from where we left off. On Thursday, we had been talking about how we might explain the Cold War and different ways of explaining the Cold War. And let me first give you an introduction that you'll hear on a couple of the PowerPoint, a couple of the audio lectures, because I thought they were the first. But what you'll want to do, as I mentioned in class, is you want to be looking at the PowerPoint when you listen to the audio lectures, and you probably want to bring in the review sheet, because there'll be terms that I'm talking about. You'll see them show up on the review sheet, and it's a good way to organize the lecture and figure out what exactly is important, since you can't ask me a question about it. You'll be able to look at it and see, okay, this is on the review sheet, I need to know this, or this is on the review sheet, and I have more questions about it, which you can ask, of course, when I get back, or email me about them. Anyway, where were we? We had finished talking about pre-World War II U.S. foreign policy. And then, of course, the United States entered World War II when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in December 7th, 1941. And the Allies, of course, won the war. And then the question becomes, what does the United States do? Does it go back to being a regional power, which is what it was before World War II, or does it become a global power? And you'll see in the early Cold War PowerPoint presentation, slide 4, regional power versus global power. And the United States made a choice between 1947 and 1952 to be a global power. And we'll talk about that choice in just a little bit when we talk about Truman foreign policy. But we had moved on from there to what was on slide 5, just sort of a little preview explaining the Cold War. And the point of that discussion was to say, all right, the United States decided to become a global power, but why did it fight the Cold War? What are the explanations for that? We gave one explanation that said it was realism, pretty simple explanation, but again, a powerful explanation that says that the reason the United States entered the Cold War is that at the end of World War II, the United States and the Soviet Union emerged as the two most powerful states in the world, and powerful states become rivals. That's what realism says. It's just plain old geopolitics. Everybody wants to run the world. And the United States and the Soviets were the rivals there, so they challenged each other, and you had the Cold War. Well, what we hadn't gotten to was idealism. Idealism as an explanation for the Cold War. Now, this is a little bit more complex. And again, we're on slide 5 now. Slide 5, item 2, idealism. This says that the reason for the Cold War is essentially values, is that the United States and the Soviet Union had incompatible values, the United States being a liberal democracy, the Soviet Union being a communist dictatorship, meaning politically a dictatorship and economically a communist state. Well, that incompatibility, we need to talk about that a little bit, because people who argue that idealism was the core of the Cold War would like to point out that the United States and the Soviet Union are different. Realists look at rivalry and power. And their argument is that the domestic political system of the United States and the Soviet Union, even if different, is an irrelevant factor in the Cold War. It didn't matter that the United States was democratic, and it didn't matter that the Soviet Union was communism. Who cares? Realists say it doesn't matter. Domestic politics doesn't matter. Idealists, on the other hand, say that domestic political systems, the values that build a country, the basic ideas, the foundations of the ideology that create the country and structure its institutions and allow its people to live certain types of lives, those are critical to explaining what happened in the Cold War. So the point there is if the domestic political system is critical, we need to get a little bit of an understanding of why there was this incompatibility. Well, obviously, you know all about the United States as a liberal democracy. Pretty obvious. We have freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly. We can form any kind of organizations we want. We can say pretty much everything that we want. We have the freedom to choose our own jobs. We have economic freedom. We choose our own leaders, and we can fire our own leaders. We can change every elected leader in the United States within a 6-year period, remove them all if they're not doing a good job. We can throw the bums out, bring in new bums. That's our political system. I've been teaching for 25 years or so at VCU. I've been teaching since 1992 at VCU, and I talk about political issues, I talk about controversial issues, and I never ever have to worry about the government coming in and saying, stop talking about this or stop talking about that. And I'm a state employee, and I can criticize the governor of the state. I can criticize the state legislature. I can criticize the president of the United States. I can write all the things I want. We are free in this country. Absolutely. No question about it. And for instance, if I was a university professor in the Soviet Union or in a communist state, well, then I have to be very, very careful about what I say. If I say the wrong thing, well, I may be killed. If I say the wrong thing, I can get thrown in prison and tortured for the rest of my life. If I say the wrong thing, I can be grabbed, I can be beaten, my house can be bulldozed, my family can be taken away from me, you know, kill my dogs, and that's just the way it was. It was a dictatorship. Now, let's back up for a second. We have a brief understanding about that, but let's talk about it systematically. Let's talk about the idea of Marxism and communism as an idea and as an ideology. And then we will talk about what you got in the Soviet Union and in other communist states, because that's very, very important. It's important to understand that as an individual living in the United States during the Cold War versus an individual living in the Soviet Union during the Cold War, life was very, very different. Democracy has its faults, absolutely. Certainly the United States' method of creating democracy has always been a work in progress. You could go back to 1952 or so and look at civil rights, for instance, but you'd notice that African Americans and other minorities did not have the same rights as white Americans. Absolutely, no question about it. But you'd also notice that if you look at the United States of 2016, the United States of 2016 might think about putting economic sanctions on the United States of 1952. So there is progress. The idea is to change things for the better. And sometimes that's two steps forwards, one step back. But certainly the ability to change things and make them better, the ability to expand the range of freedoms, that's the purpose of a liberal democracy. Very, very different from what you had in the Soviet Union. So let's go back in time a little bit and understand the theory. Now to do that, we're going to go down to slide 6. Marxism and communism. Now the Soviet Union was a country based on a Marxist or communist ideology. Same thing with the People's Republic of China, same thing with Cuba under Fidel Castro, North Korea under the Kim family, lots of different countries. When we think about the Cold War itself, it's not just a set of countries, but also a set of ideas. And that's the way idealists would look at it. It's a set of ideas that the United States is dealing with as well. So let's talk about the theory, the basic theory, and then we'll get to some more of the details about how that theory was put in practice. If you're interested in the theory itself, there's a couple links up there. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels were the two main theorists of Marxism. They're economists in the 19th century, German economists, who are actually looking at capitalism itself at the time and analyzing it. They're making an economic analysis. What's different about them than your average economist is they said, here's our analysis of economic life, and they also said, and here's how we fix it. So they had a remedy for fixing it, and that's what we're going to get to. Now, if you're also interested in sort of a basic, quick guide to communism, read the Communist Manifesto. And those are links. The Karl Marx links is to an Encyclopedia of Economics online, which is actually good and academic. And then, of course, the Communist Manifesto is online. It goes back to 1848. Well, let's talk about the theory a little bit. And when we talk about the theory of communism, there actually aren't any specific terms here, so let me just go through the basics of it. You'll see the theory, and then in practice, that says on the slide, we're going to get to in practice in a little bit. But the theory. Well, Marx and Engels are looking at communism in the 19th century, capitalism. Let's try that again. Marx and Engels are looking at capitalism in the 19th century, and looking at capitalism in England and in Prussia. Those were the two most powerful countries in Europe, the two most economically advanced countries in Europe. Marx and Engels are looking at that and they say capitalism itself is fatally flawed. But beyond fatally flawed, capitalism themselves, they said, was exploitive. It was bad. It was evil in a sense. Now, the purpose of capitalism is to generate wealth. Okay. Living in the United States today, we say, well, there's nothing wrong with that. Marx and Engels were looking at it and saying, yeah, but the accumulation of wealth that desire to accumulate wealth has awful effects on a society. Now, here's the way they looked at it. There are many classes, political classes, that exist within a society. And capitalism actually stratifies that. It creates a hierarchy of political classes. Some win, some lose. And there are a lot of classes, but the two main ones that Marx and Engels were worried about were the owners and the workers. Now, this is a society, an advanced capitalist society, where people work in factories. That's the primary method of activity. The Industrial Revolution has happened. People are working in factories. They are semi-skilled or skilled labor, most of them. That's the evolution of society. We're not talking about a farming society or an agricultural society. We're not talking about Russia. We're not talking about France in the 19th century. We're talking about England and Prussia, advanced capitalist industrial societies that are making manufactured goods. So what that does is you have a society in which just a handful of people own all those factories. They own everything. They're the wealthy in society. They do very, very well. But it's a small number of people. Then there's this gigantic gap between the wealthiest, the owners, and the workers. Most of society are workers. There's a small middle class, professional class of doctors and lawyers, but most people in society are workers. Those workers work horrendously long hours under horrible conditions and get paid almost nothing. Their lives are miserable. There are also, importantly, there are no labor laws, right? There isn't a 40-hour work week with 1 hour of breaks every day and overtime pay and benefits of health care and vacation and dental plans. That doesn't exist yet. What it is you go in the factory and you work and work and work and work and work till your fingers are bloody, and if you complain about it, they fire you and bring somebody else in. And that's that. And even with working a full-time job, you're still barely able to make ends meet. Your life is miserable. If you've ever read any Charles Dickens, this is the world of Charles Dickens, in which you work and work and work and work and work and slave away and die. And that's your life. The owners live these wonderful, phenomenal lives. Now, from the perspective of the 19th century, that's a pretty accurate portrayal of a lot of people's lives in the 19th century. The question is, what do you do about it? Well, Marx and Engels said the workers are being exploited by the owners. The workers are doing everything. And the owners are taking the fruits of that labor and becoming filthy, stinking rich and enjoying wonderful lives and just using up the workers like they're just another piece of machinery to make them wealthy. So, pretty awful situation. Now, what Marx and Engels were saying is that's life in an advanced industrial country. That's how every country will evolve into that kind of situation. And what they said is, next, you will actually get a revolution that will end that exploitive situation. Rich exploit poor, owners exploit workers, but that will end. And they said there would be a revolution, and that revolution is inevitable. What happens is the workers develop a consciousness. They realize they're being exploited. And when the workers realize they're being exploited, they say, we want to change this. And they launch a revolution. Now, again, that's a revolution that comes from an evolutionary process. Over time, as the workers live in this horrible situation where they're being exploited, they realize they're being exploited. They develop a workers' consciousness, and they launch this revolution. And Marx and Engels said that will happen in Germany, Prussia, which became Germany about that time, or England, because they're the most advanced capitalist situations. Now, what happens after the revolution? That's the really good question. Because the revolution itself will overthrow the owners, and in Marxist terms, it would take the means of production back from the owners, meaning the workers would now control the factories. It would also overthrow the governments, because what were governments at the time, according to Marx and Engels? They're just the owners creating rules in a society that allow the owners to exploit the workers. And that's all it is. It's just a way of enforcing exploitation. So in theory, Marx and Engels said, you will get this revolution. The workers will seize power. They will eliminate the owners. Then what happens? Well, that's where things get fuzzy, if you read Marx and Engels, because it's not entirely clear what happens after that. In theory, Marx and Engels say, once the workers control everything, you'll get this perfect society. It'll take some time, but you'll get this perfect society in which the workers share everything. No one is exploited, and you have perfect equality. All the workers see each other as fellow workers. You've got a consciousness which says we see each other as fellow workers, not as rivals, but as people to cooperate together to create a better society, and we share everything. Now, that's a kind of a fuzzy thing there, because the idea is that I'm going to work a lot, and I'm going to share the fruits of my labor. I'm not going to take anything more than I need. And if I don't need much, I don't take much. If I need a lot, then I'm given a lot. And the average day might be I wake up in the morning and I go fishing for 3 or 4 hours and I catch a lot of fish and then I share those fish with everyone else. And then I go put 5 or 6 hours into the factory and I work really, really hard at the factory. And then at night I go home and write philosophy because, of course, I have a fantastic education at the same time. And that's the average day, and it's a perfect day, and everybody will choose what they want to do and we'll share everything. So the idea there is that if I'm in a factory, it's another way of thinking about it. If I'm in a factory and I work in a factory and I'm making sneakers and I work really, really hard and I make 1,000 sneakers a day, we'll just come up with a number. That's great. That's fantastic. I contribute 1,000 sneakers. The person who works next to me on the next machine, that person doesn't work as hard as I do and that person makes 100 sneakers a day. Okay, that's fine. They make 100, I make 1,000. I make 10 times more sneakers than that other person. Now, in a capitalist society, we who grew up in a capitalist society, our psychology and the way we think about it is that if I make 10 times more sneakers than the guy next to me, I should get paid 10 times more, right? I should get rewarded for my labor because I'm working really hard and I want a reward for that. That's capitalism. I make 10 times more than you or work 10 times harder than you, I expect to be compensated for that. And if I'm not compensated for that, I'm looking for another job, or maybe I don't work as hard. Right? It's not necessarily an admirable way of seeing human psychology, but it seems to be a pretty accurate way. I want a reward for my labors. Now, in the communist system, it works a little bit differently. If I make 1,000 sneakers a day, but I'm unmarried and have no children, well, I put in a lot, 1,000 sneakers, but I don't get much back from society because I don't need it. The guy next to me at the other machine who makes 100 sneakers a day doesn't contribute a whole lot, but he's married and has 10 kids. So he might actually get 10 times more than I get because he's got 12 mouths to feed, right? We'll assume actually that his wife's working as well, so we can cut that in half. Maybe his wife's working at another machine, and she makes another 100 or so. So I don't make 10 times more than that family. I make 5 times more than that family. But they might get 5 times more than I do because they have such greater need because they have so many more children. So I work really hard. I get very, very little in compensation because I don't need it. The people next to me don't work as hard, but they get a lot of compensation because they need it. There's an old Marxist phrase, from each according to his work, to each according to his need. And even though I get much less when I'm working much harder, I'm okay with that because that's what that worker's consciousness means. I say, I'm okay with that because they need things and I don't. And then we live in this utopian society where we're all willing to share everything. Well, that's the theory of it. Now, very importantly to understand, Karl Marx, in all his writings, and there are thousands of pages of Karl Marx writings, Karl Marx never said, kill everyone who disagrees with you. And that's an important point. Because we'll see, communism in practice, well, that's different from the theory. In theory, what would happen is there's a transition phase. The workers overthrow the owners, and of course overthrow the government. They become the new government, and that new government, run by the workers, restructures the state into this utopian state where everybody shares everything, and then everything works out just fine. And then at that point, the government is no longer needed because all you have are the economic relationships. Now that might sound fuzzy to you, and it probably should be, because how does that work out? Well, that fuzziness is the essence of the problem that you had with communism. In practice, the workers overthrew the owners. And actually the workers, interestingly enough, in most of the states were not the leaders of the revolution. It was upper middle class intellectuals who were leaders of the revolution, and they launched the revolution on behalf of the workers. Well, these upper middle class intellectuals became the government, and the government never withered away. The government never disappeared. The government basically said, what we need is absolute power in order to create a perfect communist state. We need an absolute power in order to create a state where everything is owned by everyone, where it's collectivization. What that meant is the government simply seized every aspect of the economy and controlled the economy. And what happened is these governments became dictatorships, complete dictatorships. And they said, no political freedoms, no freedom of speech, no freedom of the press, no freedom of assembly, one political party that governs everything. If you stand in the way of communism and of the political leadership, you are crushed. You are simply crushed. You are arrested, tortured, executed without trial. Just miserable, miserable life in these really horrendous dictatorships, and dictatorships that not only wanted to control your behavior, but wanted to control your mind. They said, not only should you behave the proper way, but you need to really believe. If you get a chance, read the book 1984 by George Orwell. If you haven't read it, you should read it immediately. It's a discussion of Soviet communism. People often said it was a prediction about communist life in Europe. Well, it wasn't really a prediction. George Orwell was a journalist. He was looking at the Soviet Union and life in the Soviet Union. He called it 1984 because he wrote it in 1948. And it was a warning. This is what the Soviet Union is. And it's a dictatorship, a brutal dictatorship, which basically hammers the people over and over and over again in an effort to make them really believe in the communist state. And what they're trying to do is create that consciousness through coercion. And that's a scary thought, because Marx didn't think that that was going to be necessary. But that's what they were doing. We'll create this workers' consciousness where everybody wants to share out of coercion, which means you're so afraid that you believe. And that's a scary proposition. So, a dictatorship without political freedoms and without economic freedoms as well. What happened is it created a command economy, which means the government controls every aspect of economic life. It says what a factory is going to produce, how much of that unit the factory is going to produce, how many workers the factory is going to produce, how many hours the workers are going to work, and brutal hours as well. You don't get paid in the sense that we get paid. You get money and you go spend it whatever you want. You get paid essentially in coupons that you can use only at stores that are controlled by the government. So there is no free market, whatever. There is no private enterprise. It's complete, absolute control. They refer to it as totalitarianism. Not just authoritarianism where the government pushes around the opposition and limits political freedoms, but totalitarianism where the government wants to control every aspect of your life. And in every aspect of your life, what you're allowed to read, where you're allowed to go to school, where you're allowed to get health care, how much health care you get, who you're allowed to marry, what you're allowed to worship. And in most cases, you're not allowed to worship, because what do you worship? You worship the state. Religion is eliminated, and you have to worship the state itself as your, essentially, your God. Well, that's a theoretical version of it, but what happened in practice, in detail? Slip over to slide 7, communism in the Soviet Union under Lenin and Stalin. Soviet Union became a communist state in 1917 and then tried to create the revolution itself under Lenin and under Stalin. Well, if you oppose the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, you were crushed. In the 1950s, it's estimated 20 million people were killed simply because they opposed communist policy. They opposed the collectivization of agriculture. They imposed aspects of industrialization. They actually wanted to live as free people. 20 million people starved to death because the economics weren't working, or were simply crushed under the weight of state oppression. So not exactly the situation that you want to have, and obviously a system that is not compatible with the United States. Slip over to slide 8, communism in power in China. China became communist in 1949, and estimates are from 1949 to 1976 under Mao Zedong, and there's Mao, the leader there. Mao had pretty much absolute power at different times. Sometimes he had rivals, but every time he had a rival, they were eventually killed. But estimates are that 50 to 100 million people in that period starved to death or simply crushed under communism. So this was a brutal, brutal dictatorship. And this is the way it was in all communist states. You oppose the government, you oppose what the government was trying to do, and you are wiped out. Now, there are some other states which people talk about as socialism. Socialism as practiced, for instance, in Sweden. Right? Very, very different from this. And Sweden was a democracy. It has a socialist state. They called it socialist, but very, very different. All it means is a high tax burden and a lot of social services are handed to you by the state. That's very, very different. That's an advanced welfare state. And if you don't like the advanced welfare state and the policies there, in the next election, get rid of the leaders. And that's fine. If you said in China, hey, Mao Zedong, I'm not really happy with the political system here. Get ready to spend their life in a prison if you're lucky. Or get ready to spend the rest of your life, which could be about 3 or 4 days, in a prison until you're executed. In a lot of cases, what they did under communism is they'd put you in a jail cell and they tell the people who worked at the jail, stop feeding them. And they'd just starve you to death slowly to send a message. Well, brutal, brutal system. So idealism suggests, as an explanation for the Cold War, that this is what was going on, is that the United States looked at the system that was in communism and the system in communist states and said, we can't allow that to expand. That's awful. It's brutal. It's horrible. We can't live in a world where that exists. We can't let it spread. Obviously, we need to prevent that from spreading to Western Europe. We obviously need to prevent that from spreading in East Asia, beyond China. We need to prevent that from spreading to the rest of the world. And that's a noble endeavor because they're bad guys. And that's why we're fighting them. That's the idealist argument. Let's go back to slide 5 because we had number 3, explaining the Cold War economic interests. Let's think about this for a little bit. There are people that argue that the Cold War was only about economics. We've talked about politics a lot, but some people say it was just about economics. Now, there are two arguments here. There's one that says that the United States has a core belief, and we've talked about this a little bit, and we'll get more about this in just a few minutes. We have a core belief that says freedom is got to be the basis for economic life because it works. No other system than capitalism can produce jobs. No other system than capitalism can produce wealth. No other system than capitalism can produce innovation and creativity and automation and computers and cell phones and medical equipment that saves people's lives and all the things we know as progress, the kind of innovations in economics that allow, for instance, life expectancy to go up and infant mortality to go down and health and education and progress and the creation of ships and planes and a man on the moon and all of that. It also is the only system, capitalism, that preserves freedom, that you have the freedom to be an economic actor, which is the foundation of your freedom to be a political actor. So the idea is that free market economics is a good thing, and it produces healthy, thriving societies where people can be fulfilled. They can live lives that are worth something. They can live lives as free human beings. Well, sort of that's the gospel of Adam Smith. Adam Smith was one of the great capitalist theorists, but it's sort of the gospel of Adam Smith that says the United States believes that free markets are the reason why people can remain free as free individuals. So the United States wants to spread free markets around the world. The Soviet Union believes in that command economy where government controls every aspect of economic life and therefore you are not free. So here the United States is saying we're trying to build free market economics. The Soviets are trying to stop us, and that's why you have the Cold War. Again, it's sort of an idealistic aspect, but it's an idealism narrowed down to the economic interest. Well, that's one version of the economic argument. The other version of the economic argument actually is very critical of the United States. It says that the Cold War is about the United States' ability to have access to cheap labor and cheap raw materials. And that's really what was underneath U.S. foreign policy, is that we wanted the world to be open to U.S. investment because the United States wanted to be rich. And in order for us to be rich, we need to be able to take minerals and oil from developing countries. We need cheap labor to make products in another country that we can sell cheaply to Americans that we want to enrich ourselves. So it's in some ways a negative view of the United States as saying, well, we want to exploit the natural resources and the labor of the world, and therefore we need access to other countries, and the Soviet Union won't let us in those other countries. Communism won't let us in those other countries, so we can't actually get those resources. So we fight that. Well, that argument there looks at the United States and says, well, when the United States was, United States corporations are opposed in other countries. For instance, the government turns to the United States corporations and says, a corporation like the United Fruit Company in Guatemala, it was an American agricultural company which owned a vast amount of land in the country of Guatemala. And that had been traditional for decades and decades and decades. And when the government of Guatemala turned around and said, you know, you own too much of our land. We think that the people of Guatemala should own that land. And we're actually going to tell you, the United States, or the United States Fruit Company, the United Fruit Company, we're going to tell the United Fruit Company, you have to go ahead and sell your land to the people of Guatemala. United Fruit Company says, we don't want to do that. And the government of Guatemala says, yeah, but you're a foreign company and we want that land to be owned by Guatemalans. It's a process called nationalization, in which a government takes a corporation, essentially, of a foreign country and says, we're going to control it because we want it to be local. Well, that happened in the early 1950s in Guatemala, and the United States looked at it and said, well, the United Fruit Company has had its land taken from them. They got compensation, but they weren't putting it up for sale, so it's not necessarily a fair transaction. If someone walks into your house and says, I want to buy your dog, and you say, my dog's not for sale, and they say, sorry, yes it is, and give you $150 and take your dog, you think of it as theft. Well, that's what happened with the United Fruit Company. The Eisenhower administration looked at that and said they took the assets of United Fruit Company, therefore they're communist, and the United States helped overthrow the government of Guatemala in 1953. We instigated a military coup. And then United Fruit Company could continue to own the land that it owned. Well, the negative view of economic interests say, well, that's what's going on. The United States is just trying to make sure that its corporations can make boatloads of cash. And anything that gets in the way of that, like the Soviet Union or communist ideas, is a problem, is an enemy. So it's a negative view of economic interests. So remember, there are two versions of that. That's kind of useful. Well, that's a way of thinking about the Cold War. Maybe it's a realist, maybe it's idealist, maybe it's one of the two variants of economic interests. I'm not going to tell you what I think, but that's the way scholars explain it, as one of those four things, or often, as we'll see, a combination of those. Now, if you have any questions about all of that, obviously, talk to me, ask me some questions. We can get back to some of this, because this is some building block stuff that you'll understand. As we talk more about the Cold War, you'll get a good idea of whether it's realism, idealism, or economic interests. You'll have your own opinions on that. Let's move on to slide 9, U.S. Cold War policies. Well, this really sets up the structure for the early Cold War. There are six elements to it, and this is a slide that simply gives you an outline of those six elements. Elements 4 and 5 are on a different audio lecture. Element 6 is on its own audio lecture. So what we're going to do on this audio lecture is get through elements 1, 2, and 3. Right, to understand Cold War policy. And as we talk about this, we're talking about Cold War policy in the early Cold War years through President Truman and President Eisenhower and on into Kennedy and Johnson and a little bit of Nixon itself, though we'll spend more time about Nixon in some detail a little bit later on. So first 20 years of the Cold War or so, 20 to 30 years of the Cold War, this really shapes the nature of the Cold War itself and gives you the basic building blocks to understand how the Cold War was fought and how the Cold War changed over time. So let's move off from slide 9 because we'll get to slide 10, which starts with the first element of the early Cold War, anti-Soviet, anti-communism. Well, what we're talking about when we talk about here is basically the national interest as it was defined when the Cold War started. That's an important point, right? We talked about national interest and how you might define national interest. Well, how was national interest, U.S. national interest, defined when World War II ended and the Cold War began? Cold War ends, and in the late 40s and early 50s, during the Truman administration, that's what laid the foundation of policy that lasted until the Reagan administration. That's important. The ideas that Harry Truman laid down is the basis for U.S. foreign policy. Defining U.S. foreign policy interests after World War II, the basis for that lasted until the Cold War ended. So if you look at speeches by Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Reagan, you'll see similar elements. Always similar elements dating back to the way Harry Truman defined U.S. national interests after World War II. So roughly, the Truman Doctrine lasted 45 years. Now, the premises of this, and you'll see those premises in, for instance, the link there, Truman Doctrine speech of March of 1947. You read that, and that tells you everything you'll need to know. NSC 68, National Security Council Document 68 from 1950. We talked about the NSC. This was a document produced then, outlines the U.S. rearmament after World War II, basically saying the United States is going to have a large peacetime military for the first time in history. So you've got the basic speech, which outlines here are our interests, and then NSC 68 that says, and our interests can only be preserved if the United States has a large military. And obviously, that hasn't changed at all. So let's think about it. The premise of the Truman Doctrine is that the United States is in a global struggle against the Soviet Union. It's a global struggle based on who will order the world after World War II. If you think of World War II as a fight between fascism, Germany, Japan, and Italy, versus an alliance of liberal democracy and communism, for how we order the world. That was the argument. How is the world going to be struggled? Is the world going to be structured? And that was a struggle for the definition of civilization on the planet. Well, fascism was defeated. And then in this sense, the Cold War was about liberal democracy versus communism trying to structure the world and decide what kind of world will exist in the post-war world, post-World War II world. Well, that's what Harry Truman was saying, is we are in a struggle for civilization versus communism, and it's a global struggle. Now, part of that basis, a second premise, is that the Soviet Union is an expansionist threat. The Soviet Union wants to expand. So therefore, the United States has to prevent that expansionism. Take a look at slide 11, and you'll see the division of Europe. By 1948, the Soviets had gobbled up all of Eastern Europe. I mean, talk about expansionism. Within just 3 years of World War II, Poland, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, had their governments overthrown or seized by the Soviet Union, and they became communist, and they became communist dictatorships. 1949, China becomes communist. The communists win the civil war in China. So the world is becoming divided. North Korea was created communist in 1948, and you had communist movements in most of those blue states of Western Europe. You had communist movements in other parts of the world, and it looked like communism was on the march, expanding, gobbling up countries. And if you imagine a world in which the communist countries are drawn in red, map of the world, the communist countries are drawn in red, and the non-communist countries are drawn in blue, the red is expanding. And Truman sees this and says, we have to defend against this. We have to fight against this. The Soviet Union is an expansionist power, and communism is an expansionist ideology. Well, how do you do that? How do you combat against them? I'll zip over to slide 10. Truman and his successors look at the world and say, well, basically what we are developing is a bipolar balance of power. If you've taken a Poly 105 class, you've heard the term bipolarity or multipolarity. And polarity is just a shorthand, a metaphor, essentially, that international relations scholars use to say how many poles of power are there in the world. A unipolar world is when there's only one major country. Bipolar world, there are two major countries. Multipolar world, there are more than two. Well, the Cold War was bipolar, and it was a classic balance of power. And now, actually, we're switching over to sort of a realist analysis. A balance of power, and the United States and the Soviet Union formed a balance of power. And this is what it looks like on slide 12, right? The United States, our core allies, Britain, France, and Japan. And the Soviet Union had Poland and Czechoslovakia as core allies. So you have the power resources there, and in that balance, the United States wins by a landslide. Well, what do you do with Germany at the end of World War II? You can't decide who gets Germany. You cut it in half, West Germany and East Germany. Actually, it was two-thirds West Germany, really, one-third East Germany. You've got a city, the old capital of Germany, Berlin. Well, the Soviets occupied part of it. The United States, Britain occupied another part of it. What do? You cut it in half. You have a West Berlin and an East Berlin. Vietnam, cut it in half. Korea, cut it in half. Taiwan and China, well, you had a Chinese Civil War that began after World War II. Communists versus nationalists. The nationalists had been the government. They were allies with the United States. But the communists win the Civil War, and the Soviets have an ally of the Chinese communists who run the large mainland. The United States ally is the nationalist communist regime, which exists on Taiwan, this small island. In the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia versus Somalia. In the Middle East, Israel, an ally of the United States, versus Syria and Egypt, allies of the Soviet Union. Now, some of this changed and switched, particularly those top three lines. And of course, the Korea and Vietnam had wars and things developed there. But that's basically what you do, is you grab allies, you throw them on your side of the Cold War, and you hope to be more powerful than your rival. And you're competing all throughout the Cold War, to get more and more allies. You also have a balance of power of weaponry as well. You're trying to build more weaponry than your opponent. Also, there are countries in which there are civil wars going on, in which who is going to control a specific country on the map is unclear. Well, the United States backs one part of the civil war, the Soviets back the other side in the civil war. And then you fight it out and hope that your side wins. And if your side wins, well, you take that map of the world. And if the United States wins, you color it blue. The Soviets win, you color it red. So you have this bipolar balance of power existing all throughout the world. Now, what do you do? Actually, let me back off for a second. In Europe in particular, let's go back to the slide 12, balance of power. Europe, the United States, and its allies created the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which was basically a military structure to get ready for World War III. So if World War III comes, if the Soviets invade Western Europe, and there was always a fear the Soviets were going to invade Western Europe, the Soviets invade Western Europe, the military command is already structured. There's already a political decision-making process for how we make decisions for the war, and you already have troops there in Europe, hundreds of thousands of troops sitting in Europe waiting to get ready to fight World War III. Well, NATO was created in 1949. The Soviets respond in the early 1950s with the Warsaw Treaty Organization, or Warsaw Pact, which was the Soviet alliance and military command for fighting World War III. So everybody's ready to go ahead and fight. Well, you've got that bipolar balance of power. And at the time, in the 1950s, the United States, and this is a kind of important point, the United States believed that all communist countries were allied very, very closely. They were monolithic, referred to it often as monolithic communism, in which when the Soviet Union snapped its fingers, everybody else jumped. That there were no points of disagreement between communist countries. They all agreed with each other. Complete consensus, complete alliance, complete agreement, and they worked and operated as if it was one single mind. Now, by the 1960s, we knew in the United States that that wasn't true. It had never been true. We believed it. It made the Soviets much more powerful than they really were, because disagreements between the Soviet Union and China obviously began almost immediately, because if you take out the Soviet Union aspect and the People's Republic of China aspect, it's Russia and China, and they had been rivals for centuries, and part of that was left over. And rivalries between China and Vietnam, which were two communist states. So pick two communist states and their disagreements. Just like the Western Allies had disagreements. Because obviously, at the end of World War II, Britain and France had been allies against Germany, but they had been enemies for a long time. What made them allies? Well, Germany did, by being a threat. What made Germany, Britain, and France allies? The Soviet Union did. So they had disagreements there as well. They weren't going to go to war because the Soviets were there, obviously, as a greater threat. But the idea that the Soviet bloc was a monolithic bloc without any disagreements and that it would always stay completely unified, that turned out to be a mistake, but that's what we believed in the 1950s. Well, let's move over to slide 13. Slide 13 gives you another way of thinking about this. How does the United States fight the Soviet Union? Well, it contains the spread of communism. Containment is the key word that describes our goal. We can't necessarily roll back communist gains. We can't overthrow the government of Poland, for instance, the communist government, without starting World War III. It's too difficult. And we can't seize power in Moscow and get rid of the Soviet Union. The idea of taking those red states and somehow turning them blue, well, that's a long-term proposition, and it may not be possible without World War III. So what do you do? How do you deal with this? If we can't get rid of the Soviet bloc, if we can't overthrow all those countries, what we need to do is contain the Soviet Union. Prevent it from spreading any further. Now, George Kennan, who you see pictured here, was a Foreign Service officer in the State Department, and he wrote an article from the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, sent it to the State Department, and said, here's how I think we should structure our opposition to the Soviet Union. Here's how we should fight the Cold War. It was actually published in the journal Foreign Affairs, and there's a link to it, called The Sources of Soviet Conduct. It was by Mr. X, at the time, in 1947, because nobody wanted to publicize who it was from, because it was an internal State Department document that was declassified and edited a little bit for public consumption. But it was a fascinating document which says here's what containment should be. The United States stayed with containment all throughout the Cold War. There's some adjustments under Nixon and under Reagan, as we'll see a little bit later on. But basically, that was our point. Contain the spread of Soviet communism. And Kennan's argument was that if we contain it, it'll eventually collapse under the weight of its own problems. One of the problems are economics is command economies don't work. They don't create innovation. They don't generate wealth. Eventually, they'll collapse. That was our argument. But that's going to take time. So you contain the spread of communism, and eventually it will politically and economically collapse, but that may take decades. Contain it in Europe, contain it in East Asia, contain it around the world. So really important concept, because that idea of containment, that never changed all during the Cold War. Well, early on, Democrats were obviously, under Harry Truman, supportive of all these ideas. But as I mentioned before, Republicans, there was a debate. There were some Republicans who wanted to go back to being a regional power that didn't see the Soviet Union as a big threat. Other Republicans said, yeah, we're with Truman. We don't like to admit it. We're with Truman, and we have to fight the Cold War. And by 1952, those internationalist Republicans won the argument, obviously with Eisenhower winning the Republican nomination. Eisenhower wanted to fight the Cold War, just like Truman did. He had differences of opinion about how Truman fought the Cold War. Actually, he felt Truman hadn't been tough enough in the Cold War. So early on, Truman's saying, we've got to fight the Cold War, and some Republicans are saying, no, the Soviets aren't a threat. Later on, Truman is accused of not being serious enough about fighting communism. In particular, when China went communist in 1949, Mao Zedong and his followers won the Chinese Civil War, there were people who criticized Truman and said, you lost China. And Truman paid a heavy political price over that. He was accused of actually being a communist. And Senator Joseph McCarthy, a Republican, said there are communists all throughout the State Department, communists all throughout the United States government. Truman's a communist. Secretary of State Dean Acheson is a communist. That's the only explanation for why they allowed China to go communist. So it was really awful, horrible. He had obviously no evidence. None of those things were true. But McCarthy was very, very powerful until McCarthy actually started saying that there are communists in the United States Army. And then President Eisenhower, who had been General Eisenhower of the United States Army, said, there are no communists in the United States Army. And you, Senator McCarthy, are a horrendous, awful human being. And the United States Senate actually censured McCarthy, criticized him formally. And McCarthy eventually left office and drank himself to death. But McCarthy destroyed a lot of people's lives by accusing them of being communists. And said he had secret evidence that was classified that he couldn't share it. And a lot of people had their careers ruined. Politicians, people in the entertainment industry, and just average citizens. There were people, as it turns out, all throughout the United States, who had been members of a U.S. Communist Party at certain times. The United States had a Communist Party. We're a free country. The Communist Party wasn't illegal. The Communist Party in the United States actually had no alliance with Moscow either. In fact, it criticized the Soviet Union because it said the Soviet Union is a dictatorship, not an actual communist country. There was a Communist Party, and they ran for presidential candidates every year, and they lost. But they weren't actually allies of the Soviet Union. But McCarthy was saying that all these people were allies of the Soviet Union, and that makes a difference. There's one thing to have a political belief that's not popular, that is not shared by most Americans. There's another thing to be a spy for the Soviet Union. One is perfectly legal in a free country, and one is treason. Well, that's containment, and it's the basis for U.S. foreign policy for the next 45 years. Let's move to element number two of the Cold War. And this chart is a pretty cool chart, because this chart really highlights what we're talking about, and I'll walk you through this. As we said before, the United States believes in free markets. Before World War II, that was a basis of U.S. foreign policy. We talked a little bit about explaining the Cold War, and we saw two different versions of economic interests. Well, this is the version of economic interests that's a positive version of economic interests. The United States was pushing free markets. And what we were basically saying is we want as little government intervention in economic life as possible. We want corporations from one country to be able to trade with corporations in another country. We want investment. U.S. companies should be able to invest in Japan. Japanese companies should be able to invest in the United States. French companies should be able to invest in Germany. We believe that that's the best way to structure economic life. As I mentioned before, it creates wealth, it creates innovation, it creates healthy, free people, lots of jobs, it creates prosperity and all the wonderful things that you get out of prosperity. It also allows free people to create free political systems. So here's the basic way the United States thought about it, is that if you have a strong economy through free markets, right, you get a free market, you get a strong economy. People have jobs, people get raises, people can send their kids to college, people can raise their children in happy lives. If you do that, you have a free market economy, you create a strong middle class. And a strong middle class is crucial, crucial, crucial to political stability. Strong middle class means you have economic and social mobility. Right? I may have been poor when I was growing up, but I got skills through education and I wound up being middle class, or I wound up being wealthy. I had economic mobility. I may have been from socially a group or a region in which we didn't have very many prospects. I was poor, but I was able to rise above that through my hard work because of my economic freedoms. And now I'm no longer poor. I'm no longer low income. And in fact, over time, the number of people in society who are low income starts to disappear. And that even class structures themselves start to disappear, because everybody has the ability, through hard work and through talent, to rise above whatever circumstances they were in. So you have social mobility based on merit. You get a strong middle class, economic and social mobility. And what do you get out of that? You get political stability in the country. You get stable politics. If my hard work is what determines my future, well, I probably support a political system that allows that to happen, a political system that allows that to flourish. I think it's a pretty good political system. Is when I think that the economic and political system are rigged against me, that's when I oppose that political system. So freedom, economic freedom, leads to a middle class, political stability. It also leads to a failure of communist subversion. I mean, the point there, as an aspect of a Cold War policy, is to say, when the communists come around and say, here's an ideology, you're being exploited, and you need to launch a revolution, and you say, well, you know, I don't feel exploited. I'd like a raise. I don't have all the stuff I want, but I'm sending my kids to college, and I got a car. And my biggest worry is, well, I've got this project I'm working on, but I think I can do it well. And the kids, I got to get them to soccer practice. I don't really have time for a revolution. And why do I need a revolution? Who are you? So anyway, the idea is that when the communists come around and say, launch a revolution, you say, well, actually, politically, I like my situation. Economically, I like my situation. And you know what? Politically, if I don't like my situation, I vote people out of office and bring in new people. And you know what? I can run for office if I want to. So economic freedoms lead to aspects of political freedoms. And when the communists come around and say, have a revolution, you say, I don't need a revolution. Now, you'll see the asterisk there, because it's still the United States' belief that free markets actually discourage any radical ideologies. During the Cold War, it was a radical ideology like communism. But today, the United States argument often is that free markets will discourage radical ideologies like radical Islam in the 21st century. And it's kind of interesting. We'll get to this a little bit later. But when you look at countries where radical Islamic ideas flourish, most of them, well, they're not democracies, first of all, but they're also still socialist. They're also still command economies. The government controls every aspect of economic life. So there's an argument to be made that free markets, which were thought to be preventing political communist subversion in Europe, might also be able to do that in other parts of the world in the 21st century, when the bad ideology is the radical Islamic ideology. And again, we'll get to this a little bit later, but the radical Islamic ideology is an ideology of maybe, I don't know, see, of 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, it's estimates that about 100,000 Muslims share that ideology throughout the globe. That tells you something about how small it is Why it's a political factor, we'll get into detail a little bit later, but partly globalization. Globalization, a small number of people can stir up a whole lot of trouble. But back to the 1950s in Europe, the idea was that if you can rebuild countries economically at the end of World War II, rebuild them into strong, sustainable, growing economies, they are less likely to become communist. It's a really important point. It's why the United States threw money at Europe and threw money at Japan and South Korea to strengthen those economies and prevent them from falling to communist subversion. One more point. Bottom right-hand corner. Free markets lead to peace. And you might say, wow, free markets do everything. And the U.S. ideology is, yeah, free markets solve most of your problems. Now, there are a lot of criticisms of that you can have, but that's certainly been the reigning ideology that the United States has had. Free markets equal peace. How do you get that? There's an analysis of World War II that says World War II, the origins of World War II, really go back to the Depression. If you go back to the Depression, 1929, the stock market crashed, and the Depression gets worse throughout the early parts of the 1930s. The argument a lot of people make is that after World War I, you had a period of economic growth. And then you had a period of economic downturn. And nothing unusual. There's almost always a downturn in economic life, followed by growth, followed by a little bit of downturn. People refer to it as the boom and bust cycle. Economic growth, followed by slow growth, followed by rapid growth, followed by slow growth. It just seems to be a cycle that's inevitable. Well, there's an argument that people made, and this is an argument that the Roosevelt administration that fought World War II and the Truman administration that designed a lot of these policies after World War II, they both believe this idea, that the big mistake that caused the Depression was when you had slow growth, countries stopped trading with each other. And countries' governments built up trade barriers. And if you're trying to trade, and you've got to buy and sell things in order to make money, what if nobody's buying and selling things from each other anymore? Well, the economy slows down. And if that happens globally, the economy doesn't just slow down, it can crash. I mean, economic life can almost come to a halt. So there are people who argue that the problem with the problem that caused the Depression was a closing off of trade, in which Germany stopped trading with France, and France stopped trading with the United States, and Britain stopped trading with Germany, and all the major trading countries stopped trading with each other. They raised up trade barriers, tariffs, which are taxes on products when they cross a border, or quotas, which actually limit the number of goods that can be sold in a country, or outright bans and saying we're not going to trade with another country. And all those trade barriers led to economic collapse, led to the Depression. So the end of free market trading led to the Depression. And when the Depression hit, economic life was so bad that dictators sprang up in certain countries like Germany, Japan, and Italy. Dictators who sprang up and said, folks, things are bad, but if you give me power, I will solve all your problems. I can do it, and only I can do it. So give me power and I will solve your problems. And you got bad ideologies. You got Nazis. You got Imperial Japan. You got fascists in Italy. And those bad actors, those bad ideologies led to World War II. So economic downturn could have turned itself around, but free markets were restricted. That led to the Depression. And the Depression led to World War II. Well, policymakers took those ideas and said, to prevent World War III, free markets. If everyone can continue to keep trading and continue to keep trading freely and we expand those freedoms, well, what do? We prevent World War III because we'll have strong economies, political stability, and we won't get bad ideologies like Nazism. So free markets lead to peace. Now, you might look at that and say, well, some of that sounds kind of utopian. But then again, countries that trade with each other, since World War II, really just don't go to war with each other. It's fascinating. They just don't seem to do it. Now, let's hope that lasts. But that's been what we've seen. And whether it'll last or not, it's certainly what people believed at the end of World War II. Now, because of that, go to slide 15, the United States did certain things. First of all, in Europe, there was the Marshall Plan, and there's a speech from June 1947, Secretary of State George Marshall, in which the United States said, we're going to rebuild Europe, and we're going to spend billions of dollars to rebuild Europe so that we can make them strong economies. And again, strong economies, free markets, political stability in Europe, and all those blue states in Western Europe stay blue. And that's the idea. The United States did similar things with Japan and South Korea and has helped rebuild a lot of its allies, a major part of U.S. foreign policy. We also wanted to build global economic order. We created an international economic system that was designed to create more free markets and to create more free trade. And by free trade, I mean minimal government intervention in trade between countries. Our governments don't put up trade restrictions or tariffs or quotas or other barriers. We allow the people of different countries to trade with each other. We allow investment across borders. We allow the sales of goods from Germany in the United States and the sale of goods from the United States into France and Germany and Japan, all of that. So the International Monetary Fund, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which led to the World Trade Organization a little bit later on, the World Bank, all of it a system designed to create strong free market economics around the world, the opposite kind of economics from the Soviet bloc, in which all economic life is controlled by the government. Here, it's a sustained effort to reduce government intervention in economic life. We're going to get more to that when we talk about the Clinton administration, and that'll keep coming up from time to time. If you have questions about this, this would be really important. If you have anything you don't understand, let's talk about this a little bit. Let's move to the third element of the early Cold War, spreading democracy. Now we're on slide 16. I mentioned this before about a pre-World War II U.S. foreign policy, pre-Cold War foreign policy. The United States always talked about spreading democracy. We would like to see an entire world in which all countries are liberal democratic. Well, that sounds great. The good news is that we actually did that in certain areas of the world, and we're pretty successful. In Europe and Northeast Asia, the United States funded political parties, often only funding certain political parties, but that's a different aspect. You'll notice that spreading democracy had an asterisk in that first slide. Good news is that you had a lot of democracy spring up in Europe and Northeast Asia. Obviously, Western Europe became democratic. Japan is democratic. South Korea right now is democratic. As we sustain that, Philippines is democratic. Taiwan is democratic. And the United States had a role in helping all of that from time to time. Latin America and Southeast Asia, you actually had some countries as well move to democratic. Though the Latin America and Southeast Asia are kind of a mixed bag as well, because you'll see in different points where the United States did not support democratic movements. So you had some successes there and some lack of success. You'll see that on the next couple slides. So that's the good news. Some success, and our greatest success, Europe and Northeast Asia. There's some links there to maps of free nations, just as an illustration. Nothing crucial to go there. So that's the good news. Some success. There are a lot more democracies, 1950s, 1960s, democracy spread around the world. And the United States had a hand in a lot of that. On the other hand, 17, the bad news, is the United States supported a lot of non-democratic nations. They were U.S. allies, and we supported them, and we didn't care that they were dictatorships. We often didn't care that they were fascist. Why did we support non-democratic nations? Because they were anti-communist. Often, being anti-communist was good enough. We didn't care if you were democratic. In fact, often we worried that a country might become democratic because if it becomes democratic, then our friends can get voted out of office. Political leadership could come into power and say, the Cold War isn't something we want to fight. What do we get out of the Cold War? Instead, the United States looked at a lot of dictatorships and said, you want to fight the Soviet Union? And they said yes, and we said, good, we'll support you. And we'd say, would you have elections? We'd love you to have the elections. And they'd say, no, we can't have elections because the communists will win. And we say, oh, the communists will win? Then never mind, don't have elections. And now the list that you see here is a big list. It's not a complete list. The list of dictatorships that the United States supported is actually bigger than this, but I ran out of space on the slide. But if you look at this, the important thing is to look and say, well, this is all around the world, right? You see the first group, Nicaragua, Paraguay, Argentina, Guatemala, Honduras, Brazil, Latin America. We support dictatorships there. Africa, South Africa, Somalia, Algeria, Egypt, Saudi Arabia in Iran, in the Middle East, back to Africa, Kenya, Zaire, East Asia, South Korea, Taiwan, Philippines, Indonesia, South Asia, Pakistan, back to the Middle East, Turkey, Thailand, in East Asia, Cuba. At times, we supported dictatorships in these regions. At times, we actually helped some of them make a transition to democracy, like in the Philippines as well, or in South Korea. We helped make transitions. Other times, we lost countries to communism, as in the case of Cuba, but we supported a lot of dictatorships. So again, that's why there's an asterisk next to spreading democracy. Slide 18, the worst news. Here are three cases in which the United States helped overthrow democratic regimes. Prime Minister Mossadegh came to power, democracy. President Arbenz. Those are my dogs. Excuse me. Ladies. Sorry about that. I'm recording this, and the dogs are in the room, and they heard something. So back to this. Mossadegh, Arbenz, and Allende, in respectively Iran, Guatemala, and Chile, were elected democratically. They were leftist, no question about it. Allied with the Soviet Union? Not really. The evidence suggests that they were not allied with the Soviet Union, but they were leftist, and what they did is they nationalized companies that had U.S. ownership. So in Iran, it was oil companies, actually, that were British oil companies that the Iranian government said, the British are making money off of our natural resources. We want to make that money. So they actually seized British oil companies and said, we are going to control that and give that to the Iranian people. In Guatemala, it was United Fruit Company, a U.S. company that the government of Jacobo Arbenz Guzman actually said, we're going to buy this from United Fruit Company, but we're going to own it. As I mentioned, United Fruit Company didn't want to sell it. They said, don't care. Our land should be our resources. And in Chile, it was minerals like copper and U.S. companies that control large amounts of the mining interests in Chile. And President Salvador Allende said, we're going to seize those and give them back to the Chilean people. Well, they were all leftist. They all nationalized holdings of the United States or U.S. allies. And in each case, the United States turned around and said, you're too far to the left. The United States said, you're communist. The United States said, you're allied with the Soviet Union, even though, again, the evidence was very, very shaky. And the United States helped overthrow the governments. In Iran, we instigated a coup that led to the overthrow of Mossadegh, and the Shah of Iran took power, a monarchical dictator. In Guatemala, a military dictatorship came into power. In Chile, a military dictatorship came into power. So we overthrew democracies and then supported dictatorships in the name of the Cold War or in the name of economic interests. So that's the worst news. Then the last thing, slide 19, the strange news. This is interesting because in this picture you see in the middle Mao Zedong, the communist dictator of China from 1949 to 1976, may be responsible for more deaths than anyone else in the 20th century, sitting down with Richard Nixon, President of the United States. And you say, how does this make sense? Well, we'll get into the details of that a little bit later on, but if you jump up or back a little bit to slide 12. On slide 12, you'll see the balance of power in the Cold War, and you'll see China on the Soviet side. Well, China and the Soviet Union, by the late 1950s, had a whole lot of disagreements. Right? Monolithic communism didn't exist, but it was obviously showing that the concept didn't make any sense because China and the Soviet Union were becoming enemies, not allies. And that continued during the 1960s in a big way. And ultimately, Richard Nixon looked at it and said, what if we could get China, that's in that Soviet side of the balance of power, and shift them over to the U.S. side of the balance of power? Wouldn't that be great? Sure, they're dictators. Sure, they're communists. But maybe we can get them further outside of the Soviet Union. Now, China, we didn't believe was ever going to fully become part of the U.S. alliance. But if we can just get them out of the Soviet alliance and almost acting as a third part of this balance of power, that's a victory in itself. And the United States, under Nixon, back to slide 19, did that. The United States and China formed a cooperative relationship to oppose the Soviet Union. We're going to be enemies to a certain extent, but we'll also be partners in opposing the Soviet Union. We'll talk a lot about that a little bit later. It's kind of strange because here is the leader of the free will, the leader of the free world sitting down with a communist dictator. But we had one thing in common, opposition to the Soviet Union during the Cold War. So that's the strange news. So democracy, spreading democracy, we talked a good game, but it's more complex than just success. We didn't always spread democracy. I'm going to stop there, and we'll have another presentation coming up.